And so Hansel and Gretel sleep peacefully in the litter-strewn forest, guarded by the kneeling angels in pristine white who've appeared in that dream pantomime to pull a blanket over them. The end of Act Two of Humperdinck's Fairy Tale Opera, in which Alice Coote and Lydia Teuscher sang the children, Irmgard Nussmeier and William Daisley, the parents, and Tara Errol, the sandman. Members of the Glyndebourne Festival Chorus and Children's Chorus and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Robin Ticciardi, who's back on the platform, bringing the LPO to its feet. Humperdinck presented the original version of Hansel with songs and dialogue to his fiancée at Christmas as an engagement present. Then he told her he was going to make it into a real opera, which she loyally said was the right thing to do, even if it meant postponing their wedding again. But the upgrading of Hansel wasn't going well, and Humperdinck reported, "Hansel is like our engagement. The longer it lasts, the more faint-hearted I become." Well, after the interval, Hansel and Gretel finally get to meet the witch and see rather more of her gingerbread house, or in Laurent Pelly's production, supermarket, than they'd like. Between now and then, though, for the next 20 minutes, the Proms Literary Festival down at the Royal College of Music investigates the themes of the Brothers Grimm fairy tale and its relevance to children today. Here's Ian McMillan.
Welcome to this latest sweet slice of the Proms Literary Festival. Tonight's prom features Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel, based on one of the best-known fairy tales of Wilhelm and Jakob, the Brothers Grimm, which first appeared in their collection of stories published in 1812. I think Hansel and Gretel is one of the scariest of Grimm's fairy tales, with dark woods and witches and children and harsh moonlight and somebody ending up in an oven. It's a tale that stood the test of time, and once you've heard it, it hangs around in your head forever. On my childhood Sunday afternoon strolls through Great Oughton Woods, I used to always expect to see a house with sugar windows somewhere off the main path, and I was always disappointed when I didn't. All these tales are full of archetypes: loss, abandonment, fear, hunger, and a struggle between good and evil that's never too easily resolved, especially in an edible house. Here to chew on this subject, I'm delighted to welcome Anne Fine, celebrated writer of work for younger and older readers, former children's laureate and author of Madame Doubtfire, and one of our leading child psychologists, Margaret Rustin, from the Tavistock Clinic here in London. She's written extensively on psychoanalysis and the arts and has a particular interest in children's literature. So Anne, when did they write the stories? And do we know if they collected them orally first?
They did collect them. They collected them from certain people who were tremendously good at remembering them, and then a lot of their friends came in with some more. And it started entirely as a scholarly collection. I think it was something to do with the German nationalism of the sense of big Germany at the time, because, of course, it was the Napoleonic period, the problems there. But the book almost immediately began to be read by a much wider group of people, including children. And so instantly, almost, the Brothers Grimm had the sense to expand the tales so that they were more like stories. So they're much more polished as we go through the various editions. And actually make several changes. I mean, they made changes. The mother in the original version of the story, she's a mother, but she becomes a stepmother, because we don't really like cannibalistic mothers deciding to chew up their own children rather than starve to death. You know, we'll eat them. You know, it's not really good, is it? So things like that. And then I think the violence was increased because they thought it went well, whereas a lot of the more indelicate aspects, you've got to remember this is sort of Germany's Victorian period, were played down. So Rapunzel, for example, in her tower, she no longer gets pregnant. In the original story, she says, "Why are my clothes so tight?" But it's Baudelaire's down to, "Why is the prince so much heavier to lift up than you are, mother?" You know, sort of thing. So all these changes made it more suitable for children, and the editions just rolled off the presses.
Because we do sometimes forget that they were written for adults as well as children, and so they were just Baudelaire'd,
yes,
as you say. So, Margaret, in the Grimm story, Hansel and Gretel, it's a stepmother, and in the opera, it's a mother, and we're talking about the differences in a minute. But how important is the mother figure in this story and in fairy tales in general, do you think?
Well, she's often missing. And I would say that the fact that stepmothers are so important in many fairy tales, including this one, is because what we've got to have in mind is the images and the thoughts about the missing mother, the lost mother, as well as the replacement. So the way I would think about this story is that the stepmother, one version of a mother, the witch, another version of a mother, and perhaps the birds, who are other versions of the mother, sort of turned into a kind of bird figure, as in other stories too, are all different versions of what might go on in a child's mind when they've lost a mother.
Because those birds, they're often written out. Sometimes, as children, we did read even more simplified versions, didn't we, Anne?
And I think also, I mean, it doesn't even have to be an absent mother. I mean, without treading on any particularly sensitive toes, because everybody is dead in my family who would want to argue with me about this. I mean, my mother had a temper, and she was certainly not an absent mother. I mean, she was a solid mother who did the job of mothering. But by golly, she had a temper, and she could appear to be, to all of us, I think, quite dangerous at times. And what I think I loved stepmothers for is that if you'd had a row with your mother, or your mother had been in a mood and really had a go, you could go upstairs and you could read these stories and you could hate the witch because you weren't really hating your own mother, which at the time you probably did, because children are full of the most fierce feelings. Mm.
But I think when you say you could go upstairs and forget that it was mother downstairs that you were furious with, you could also say that, you know, when you get very, very angry with somebody that you perhaps fundamentally love and you may be full of hate for them, in a way you have lost the good mother. And what you've got in your mind is the witch mother, the bad one, the stepmother.
Of course, we must remember that at the time these were being written as well, there was a time of famine.
Yes.
So hunger...
Absolutely.
..is very much in the story, isn't it? Mm. And it seems to me the mother in the story and the opera, she's very angry. Is that this feeling you get, that she's an angry mother?
She certainly is in the story. Because she doesn't just get rid of them once in the original story. She doesn't even think better of it. I mean, they come back with the pebbles trick, which is, of course, a marvellous way of teaching resourcefulness to children. You know, wait for the moon to come up and you'll find your way home. But in the original story, of course, they plot to do exactly the same thing again later, which really is naughty, isn't it? Whereas, of course, in the opera, that's all softened down. They only go out once and it's almost an accident. I mean, she must be the only person in this great dark wood who has forgotten there's a witch in it when she sends them out as it gets dark.
It struck me, Margaret, reading the story, obviously in translation, it feels very dreamlike. There's a real dreamy quality to it.
I think that's absolutely right, and perhaps that's one of the things that got a bit developed in the opera that we're going to see later, because the what goes on when the children fall asleep is a significant part of the libretto.
But it seems to have a strange kind of logic that dreams have, and things seem to happen in a very rapid way, like they do in dreams. I just wonder, somehow in these stories, there's a fundamental dreamlike quality.
Well, I think fairy tales are rather like dreams, the speed that you speak about, but also the extremity of everything. I mean, things are very good or very bad, very fast or very slow. They don't have the quality of the quotidian experience of the passage of time. It's completely different. Night and day are not really distinguishable. I think that's right.
I don't think of them as dreamlike at all. I think of them as absolutely rooted. The vocabulary is so elemental, isn't it? Forest, dark, crust of bread, you know, sort of witch, mother. I mean, it's very elemental, I think. I don't think of them as dreamlike stories at all. And I think one of the reasons why they resonate with everybody so much is because they're not where you have to learn a whole new way of doing things. I mean, you don't. It's not like Narnia or Discworld, where there's all these other rules.
You see, when one says dreamlike, I think you've got to think of it as a very young child's dreams. They wouldn't be like our dreams, which are, you know, more distinct, perhaps, from the everyday. And when you talk about there being a different kind of language or visualisation in dreams, that might be true for adults. But if you think about a child's dream world, I think this is it's much more similar. Mm-hmm. These are very stark images, aren't they?
Well, they are stark
dark
images,
light,
for sure.
Hot, cold, hunger, repletion. I think those are the things of a very small child's preoccupation.
But they do continue to resonate. I mean, absolutely. even hunger, which clearly is not going to be anything like the hunger of a child in a forest all those years ago. But I think children are still starved for attention. They're starved for time now. And there's this desperate attention-seeking need that children have where they're sort of clawing at you, wanting to, let me tell you something. I want something to tell you. I want to tell you something.
These fairy stories are full of these primitive impulses that presumably the children will come to you. I'm just impulses like, you know, hunger we've talked about, abandonment, that
kind of
thing.
I think the fear of loss and how you cope with loss when you have lost something is so prominent in fairy stories, but also fantastically prominent in much of the best of children's literature, in my opinion.
What about deep, dark woods, Anne? There's always a lot of deep, dark woods in these stories.
Well, I mean, deep, dark woods. We all have dark times, don't we? I mean, I'm quite interested in this business of abandonment and loss in these fairy tales, because although I have written about all sorts of families, it hasn't escaped my notice that the books that have been way and away more successful than any of the others are the ones that deal with families in trouble, divorced families, reconstituted families. And
that's modern loss, isn't it?
Which is modern loss. And of course, it's altered in that before it was presumably the mothers who almost routinely died in childbirth, whereas now I think there are seven stepfathers to every live-in stepmother. So the sex of the step-parent has changed. But the anger and the rage, I mean, I write the books and I get the letters, and it is astonishing. You know, you wrote about goggle-eyed, he was quite a nice stepfather. I have a stepfather, and I will never, ever, ever get to like him.
But what about old Bettelheim, who said that children can grapple with the fears in remote symbolic terms, and the things that we've been talking about, the fear and the anger, through fairy stories?
Well, I think that was Bettelheim's best idea. I mean, Anne and I were talking about having reread Bettelheim, and being irritated by some of the sort of literalism, I think, with which he thinks about these stories. But I think his very, very important insight, and it was a very unusual thing to say very loud and clear at the point where he wrote it, was that rather than the notion that these stories are, you know, might be too much for children because they're full of such terrible things, actually children's minds and lives are full of terrible things, and that to have symbolic representation for it is very, very helpful. So I think that was really important.
I have to ask about one more primitive anxiety, which is eating children, which happens in, or is about to happen in Hansel and Gretel. That just seems a terrible, terrible thing. And what does that mean?
We do have to face the fact that where there is famine, there is cannibalism.
I think when you think about the really quite infantile roots of some of these things, of what hunger can feel like for a baby, for a very small child who doesn't yet really have a kind of grasp of the everyday realities at all. It can feel as if you're being eaten from inside, can't it? And the child that's feeding at the breast can sometimes be felt by the mother to be eating her alive. So these are feelings and kind of images as well as notions of hunger, starvation or potential actual cannibalism in particular circumstances.
Now, Anne, in your books, you've written, as we talked about, a lot about reconstructed families with stepmothers and stepfathers. What about the father in Hansel and Gretel? Because he feels a very weak man to me, because he willingly lets his wife lead the children into the woods and leave them twice. He's very weak.
No, I think that is one of the things that, you know, children today, it resonates very much with children today, because very often in leaning over backwards to please a new partner, a parent will very often not stick up for the child of the original marriage, and it's a serious problem for many children. And I think he comes over as a deeply weak and a morally reprehensible father, and one is almost, you know, quite cross at the end that, you know, the mother figure just conveniently dies in the story and they find a few pearls and diamonds, and you think, you got off very easy. You did. You were pretty
crummy parent, to be honest. And I think there'd be a lot of children today who would say, you know, that they deeply resent the fact that their father does not stick up for them if he doesn't want to get into an argument.
The libretto picks up an interesting thing about that, because when the father arrives home and mother sent the children off to pick the fruit in the forest, he threatens to beat her. So I think we need to bear in mind that the context is one of domestic violence and patriarchal control through violence. Myself.
And we do have to remember that this is the cleaned-up version.
Yeah.
Because, of course, in
but
this one...
But not completely cleaned-up, as that point makes it clear.
In this one, you know, it is purely an accident that she sent them to collect strawberries, and an accident that they started mucking about with the strawberries and ended up, you know, in the position where they're in the dark and can't find their way home. Purely an accident, not in the original story, of course, at all. Mm.
So there are quite big differences between the opera...
Oh, hugely so, hugely so. I mean, the parents, I think, just become, you know, nice people. Well, one can quite understand why she would come home after a hard day's work, not having had any success at selling something. She finds they're mucking about. She's irritated beyond measure with them, quite justifiably, because these are hard times and they should have been getting on with their chores. And she ticks them off, and then the only food in the house, this milk that is just so precious, gets knocked off the table. And she orders them out of the house, probably is a sensible move, so as not to kill them herself. And off they go to look for these strawberries. And even then, you know, they're foolish enough to start scoffing them and not bring them home. So I think the parents come out very well in the opera, and they go immediately to look for them. It's a completely different story, actually. And you can see why, because if it's a Christmas story... Who wants to see the original story? At Christmas, you'd all come home and be eyeing each other with a very beady eye all evening, wouldn't you?
But, Margaret, I think it's true that the music is very Christmassy, in fact.
Well, much of it is. Mm. I mean, there are moments when, you know, the surface is ruffled a bit more, but, you know, some of the most famous songs from the opera are... You know, lullabies to the children to sleep. I mean, we're definitely being taken into a very angelic sphere a good deal of the time, which is a long, long, long way away from Grimm's version.
Let's talk about the witch, because witches aren't often important in Grimm's tales, but what about this one? Here's a description of her. She'll sound like me, sadly, because I'm not an actor, but here we go. The old woman had only pretended to be kind. She was really a wicked witch who waylaid little children and had built the house of bread just to get them inside. As soon as a child fell into her hand, she killed it, cooked it, and ate it. Witches have red eyes and can't see very far, but like animals, they do have a keen sense of smell, and they can always tell when a human being is around. When Hansel and Gretel got nearer, she laughed fiendishly and hissed, "They're mine. This time, they won't get away." Early in the morning, before the children were up, she got out of bed and gazed at the two of them, sleeping so peacefully with their soft red cheeks, and she muttered quietly to herself, "They will make a tasty little morsel." She sees a bit much, isn't she? But see, the last time I saw Hansel and Gretel was a pantomime, and the witch and the mother were played by the same third division celebrity. And it just struck me that... Is there an idea that they are actually... They're versions of each other, the witch and the mother?
Well, I think they're the two sides of the mother in the children's mind.
Yes, no, I'd agree with that entirely. I think, yes, that they are alter egos for one another, if that's the word. And I don't think anybody has a problem with that, because you know, the mother's dead when the witch dies and they come home in the story. I mean, she's vanished. Nobody quite explains where she's gone.
But I think what you read out sort of underlines is another very powerful theme in this particular fairy tale, which is... The incredible layers of deceit. I mean, everybody deceives everybody else all the time. We are absolutely in a world where nobody trusts anybody, except the children trust each other, which is interesting, because the sibling link, which isn't such a common thing in fairy tales, does come out quite nicely, I think, in this one.
And I wonder if, as adults, we feel any unease about children reading this story or reading it to them. The other day I was in Cleethorpes with my grandson, and we were picking blackberries, and I told him the tale as we were gathered around this bush, and he was made nervous by it. But I thought, well, we're supposed to be able to tell Franny tales. Should we feel uneasy telling this tale?
I feel huge unease about bits of them. I mean, I went out to my daughter's, who's in Melbourne, and I had the original Snow White that I'd used for her childhood. And on the last page, there was a yellow sticker that I actually sellotaped over the last line, which was about, this is Snow White, about the witch being forced to dance in her red-hot iron shoes until she was dead. And I'd obviously censored it.
But I think that there is a kind of unease which is misplaced, which is the notion that, you know, children don't know about all these horrible things and we'd be introducing them to them, which I think is not true.
So finally, at the end of the story and the end of the opera, the witch does get her comeuppance, but it's over very quickly, isn't it? It suddenly happens. You think it happens too quickly?
Not for Christmas, somebody frying alive in an oven, no.
I think perhaps it has to be over quickly because it is, I mean, unbelievably sadistic. And if it was expanded in terms of paragraphs of description, then it would have a kind of quite repellent thing, whereas it remains sort of fairy tale-ish because it happens just like that.
And it's satisfying, isn't it? Mm. It's satisfying. I mean, she's sent off to the fires of hell for her bad behaviour, as it were.
And I'm afraid we have to end the conversation there. Thanks to my guests, Anne Fine and Margaret Rustin. I'm off to my house in the woods, made of Yorkshire puddings, of course.
I thought it might be Barnsley Chops. Ian McMillan was talking to Anne Fine and Margaret Rustin. The programme was produced by Dymphna Flynn. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. From me, Martin Handley, to the second part of this evening's BBC Prom live on Radio 3, where Humperdinck's fairy tale opera is poised in midair with Hansel and Gretel asleep in each other's arms in the scary forest. In this performance, a semi-staged version of Glyndebourne's current production by Laurent Pelly, the children are sung by Alice Coote and Lydia Teuscher, The Dew Fairy by Ida Winhead, and Mother and Father by Irmgard Wilsmeyer and William Daisley. Members of the Glyndebourne Festival Chorus and Children's Chorus and the London Philharmonic Orchestra are conducted by Robin Ticciarti. And in Act 3, we finally get to meet the witch, sung by Wolfgang Ablinger Speerhacker. He told me how well it can work, having a man playing the role.
Because like that, you can't really distinguish anymore which gender the witch is. It's truly not a drag queen, because it has to be sort of a he, she, it, being not bound by gender, not even by place or something. And that makes it even more scary, because it's coming like from an outer world. Mm. I think that's also the reason why it's now quite popular to cast it with a man. And of course, there is a lot of comedy because of that. There are amazing possibilities in the piece, as the piece is so diverse and has so many nasty undertones in it, which you can then bring out. And it's not just a lovely fairy tale, or like every fairy tale, it has its bad side.
Have you enjoyed being the, well, what do we call you? The evil pantomime Dane? What do you call yourself, actually?
The evil owner of an awful supermarket which fattens children.
Act 3 of Hansel and Gretel begins at dawn in the forest. The Dew Fairy, dressed in see-through plastic mac hat and wellies, shakes dewdrops from a see-through handbag over Hansel and Gretel to wake them, and they discover that they had the same happy angelic dream. They can hardly believe their eyes when a miniature Royal Albert Hall made of packets of sweets is revealed. They can't resist and nibble happily away. They think they hear a voice from somewhere near, but persuade themselves it's just the wind, until, that is, the distinctly overweight witch herself appears in a pink twin set and pearls. She opens the dome of the Albert Hall and packs two plastic bags with sweets. But the children are frightened, and as they try to run away, she casts a spell on them. She leads Hansel into a cardboard box with bars on it, where she intends to fatten him up before eating him. Hansel may be paralysed under the witch's spell, but he can still tell his sister to watch exactly what she does, which is to first to feed him sweets. She then removes the immobilising spell on Gretel and tells her to go and lay the table. The witch checks that the outdoor oven is heating up nicely. It is. The Albert Hall model is beginning to smoke, and she uses a broom to croon into as she goes into a song and dance number of anticipatory delight, crowned by her sharpening two huge knives with glee. The witch feeds Hansel some more sweets and doesn't notice as Gretel undoes the spell on her brother. As Hansel quietly climbs out of the prison box, the witch asks Gretel to pop her head in the oven to see if the gingerbread is brown yet. Hansel warns her not to do it, and Gretel, pretending she doesn't understand the witch, asks her to show her what to do. When the witch is half into the oven, the children give her a big shove and slam the oven door shut. Or in this case, push her into a cardboard box. Hansel and Gretel hug each other and dance, and to their amazement, the Albert Hall oven explodes. A long row of children appear, in fat suits. The witch has been feeding them up. They sing softly, but can't really move. When Hansel and Gretel touch them, they smile and open their eyes. But it's only when they remember how to undo the spell that the children can finally dance around their saviours. Father and mother catch up with Hansel and Gretel, and there's a joyful reunion. As for the witch, well, she's been turned into sweets. So, all is ready for Act Three. And here comes Robin Ticciati to conduct the final act of Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel.
Oh! Watch her feet! Their feet!
Ach, liebe Kinder, höre nun sie, wird euch bei diesem Vergnügen vergehen.
Weil meine Augen und Ohren sind gut, haben wohl aus, was Schaden mir tut. Ich trau nicht dem gleißenden Wort.
Doch,
Hässig Gretel muss mir dran, mit dir mein Mann fang ich an. Bist du nicht zart und rund, wie gemacht für Hexenmund?
Ha 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 ha! mein Gänselchen.
Mein Tor, hol mir kurz mein Gänselchen.
Hihi,
hol mir kurz mein Gänselchen.
Hihi, mein gutes Fröppchen, da steckt dir was ins Kröpfchen.
Schwester,
ist die
Wein, und ich
fahr
mich an, das ist schon
das wunderbar, wie Hexe hexen kann, wie sie halt Knospen halt, immer so zum Kunst.
Schaut, schaut das Wunder an, wie die Hexe hexen kann, wie sie halt Knospen halt, immer so wunderbar.
Sie sind Mischlergericht, diese Männer kommen nicht, wenn die nur das Höchste streicht, Gott der Herr sich
When your distress is more than you can bear, the dear Lord God will answer your prayer. The moral at the happy end of the fairy tale. Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel, performed here at the BBC Proms in the Glyndebourne Festival production by Laurent Pelly, revived and directed for the Royal Albert Hall by Stefan Marlowe. And the children, fat suits and all, have just taken their bow. Here comes Tara Erort, the Sandman, making her Proms debut. All in white glitter, white glittery helmet. And the Dew Fairy, Ido Winland, also Proms debutante, in her see-through rain attire. She's wearing something underneath, I should say, and greened up. William Daisley, the father. Tracksuit, trainers, lanky, greasy hair. And that could almost describe Mother, Irmgard Wilsmeyer. What a Proms debut. Great singing. She's going to sing Kundry in Estonia soon. Guess who this is? He succeeded. Wolfgang Ablingosperhacke, the Wicked Witch, putting his hand to his ear. He reappeared in sort of brown slip and a dirty housecoat with his name label on it. Absolutely disgusting. Alice Coote, Hansel. Full of energy still. Did have a double espresso before she started, I have to say, but fantastic energy. Every bit the boy, scabs on the knees and all, as has Gretel, Lydia Teuscher, making her Proms debut. She says when she can't remember what it felt like to be like a child, she looks at her little son, who's not very old, and remembers exactly what it's like. And she's dashed off to fetch Robin Ticciati, who will no doubt bring the London Philharmonic leader, Peter Schumann, to its feet. Fantastic applause for the London Philharmonic. What a score that is. So rich, so varied, so touching. Well, tomorrow night's BBC Prom at 7:30, as always live here on Radio 3, has a programme which I think Humperdinck would have approved. The last youth orchestra this season, the Gustav Mahler Jugend Orchestra, conducted by Herbert Blomstedt in two symphonies, Hindemith's filleting of his opera Matisse der Mahler, Bruckner's final ninth. Between them, Christian Gerhard of the baritone in Mahler's Lieder eines Fahrenden Gesellen, Songs of a Travelling Wayfarer. Another evening to look forward to, but as the children take another bow and the audience digests its very satisfying musical gingerbread, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say a little more of Alice Coote, in a minute or so. For the moment, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in 17 minutes' time, Wheels and Stones. Robert Powell reads from the Wheelwright Shop about making wooden wheels and wagons. That's at 9:30. Followed at 10:15 by jazz trumpeter and current Radio 3 new generation artist Tom Arthurs, performing his own suite, Postcards from Pushkin. Until then, back to tonight's Hansel, one of the first of the Radio 3 new generation artists, Alice Coote. Here in a world not a million miles away from Humperdinck's fairy tale opera, Mahler songs from that German anthology of poems, Des Knaben Wunderhorn, The Boy's Magic Horn. This first of them, Rhine Legend.
Und nun adieu. Geschwind.
The singer there, Alice Coote, with pianist Julius Drake in four of Mahler's songs from Des Knaben Wunderhorn, ending there with Urlicht, which of course found its way into Mahler's Second Symphony. And as Martin Handley was saying earlier on, more Mahler songs in tomorrow night's BBC Prom. Christian Gerhaher in the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, Songs of a Wayfarer, along with Bruckner's Ninth Symphony and Hindemith's masterpiece, the Matthias der Mahler Symphony. Herbert Blumstedt conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and that's at 7:30 tomorrow night at the Royal Albert Hall and live here on Radio 3. It's 9:30, and now on Radio 3 we have another chance to hear Wheels and Stones. Judith Kampfner takes us across the landscape of Britain to observe a stone carver, coach builders and a jeweller who proudly defend their traditional crafts. Though the world around them moves on and threatens their skills, they take a longer-term view. Their work is deliberate and painstaking. It's based on tradition, experience and passion, as championed by George Sturt in his book The Wheelwright's Shop. Robert Powell reads extracts from Sturt's unique account of a business at the turn of the 20th century.
To say that the business I inherited in 1884 was old-fashioned is to understate the case. Thousands handed on each his own little bit of understanding, passing it on, linking up the centuries.
Farnham, Surrey. George Sturt, aged 21, leaves his budding career as an assistant master at the local grammar school and takes over the wheelwright's shop that was founded by his grandfather, also called George Sturt.
In 1884, my father died, and I, for my part, did not know how to carry on even the ordinary aspects of the wheelwright's business. I had no more than a month of my father's guidance in it. He grew too weak and died 4 months later.
The premises consist of workshops, timber yard, saw pit, and a platform for mounting iron tyres onto the handmade wooden wheels. At the back is a hop ground, and the workshop looks out onto the Guildford Aldershot Road.
I had been teaching since I was 15. All that meant was that I had book-learned ignorance when it came to this trade. But some books helped me. Ruskin's Fors Clavigera helped me see that man's only decent occupation was in handicraft, and so his ideas swayed me. After I entered the trade, I continued to read Ruskin, and he saved me from the worst sordidness of business.
In 1923, 3 years after he retired, George Sturt wrote a book which was an account of the 36 years he'd spent running the family business. He called it The Wheelwright's Shop. The historian of the British working class, E.P. Thompson, has called it a work of classical distinction whose testimony must weigh heavily in the scales of judgment. The Times Literary Supplement said, "The author shows a combination of the gifts of the handicraftsman with the powers of a writer in a way not common in English literature." I first came across the book in my school library, a strange choice for an all-girls school. I wasn't the slightest bit interested in crafts, least of all building a wheel myself. But what was immediately delightful about this odd book was its lovingly detailed account of all aspects of a business. It has photos of piles of drying planks and dung carts and tiny hand-drawn sketches in the margins of the underside of an axle bed, sections of wheel rims, and each chapter is broken down into the specific stages of each phase of the work, and at the end is a glorious glossary.
Bavins, bundles of the sprays or lightest branches of timber. Coomed up, possibly gummed up. A wheel on which the grease had gone dry and stiff was said to be coomed up.
A glimpse of a man who had no pretensions but was just faithfully documenting his working life. Sturt wrote the book at the age of 60 under the pseudonym George Bourne. Even though he'd retired, he was worried that any association with a literary man might damage the business for his successor. Despite the matter-of-factness and modesty, there's also drama here. He struggled during his 3.5 decades as a coach builder and wheelwright, juggling his passion for reading with the duties of business. In the early years, he'd been uncomfortable, and his men knew it.
The men for years called me by my Christian name. It was many years before they called me the Governor. The 8 men we employed were older than myself, but they seemed to me often like a lot of children. tiresome children sometimes.
I see, you know, many parallels with the position that Sturt was in.
Simon Verity is a distinguished stonemason and sculptor, but I'll let him be more precise.
Well, I'm not really a stonemason. I work with stone. I suppose that you could call me a sculptor, in that the word comes from the Latin sculptere. But what a mason does is to cut straight lines, mostly. I'm not very good at straight lines. You know, I love curved forms, and if I had to just do straight lines all the time, I would go crazy.
Simon's worked all over the world on cathedrals, grand houses, and private and public gardens. I first met him in a New York park, where he was laying a map of the British Isles in carved paving stones as a memorial for the British victims of 9/11. It turned out he also knew and admired George Sturt's writings.
I think he saw the nobility of what his tradition was. He had a feeling for it, and towards the end of his life, he was very nostalgic for it.
Unlike Sturt, Simon Verity didn't inherit his business, but he did leave school to live with his great-uncle in an artist community in the Cotswolds, which had ties with the arts and crafts movement.
I'm cutting a V letter into the stone. It seems to me that most of the work I do in stone, it's a question of changing the weight of the hammer.
Now, lettering interests you a lot, doesn't it? And it was something that you worked on as a young man.
Yes, my great-uncle, Oliver Hill, was a very interesting maverick architect who mostly worked between the wars, and he was my mentor, and he'd worked with the sculptor and letter cutter Eric Gill on several projects, and he had a real extraordinary feeling for materials and a curiosity, so that he was able to transmit that spark to me, and it's been pervasive in my life for 45 years. I've just been chipping away.
For the complete wheelwright, acquiring skill of eyes and hands to make a wheel was good, but then also the job of building a wagon throughout and painting it was also expected of him.
The word wright derives from an old German word meaning work. As in playwright and shipwright, there's a strong sense of hard, honest labour. Today, Crowford's coach-building business in Kent continues the traditions of Sturt's trade, although they do have some machines. Ed Crouch is the boss, Tim Brisley the foreman, and Nick Gill is second wheelwright.
A lot of country wheelwrights had their own trademarks. They would be able to tell their own wheels, their own wagons, and they would build things for individually for certain farmers, would have a certain demand for a narrow gateway, so they'd build a wagon to fit that gateway or a certain load, and they'd build their wagons to fit those requirements.
In farm wagon or dung cart, barley roller or plough, the dimensions we chose, the curves we followed, and almost every piece of timber was curved, were imposed on us by the nature of the soil, in this or that farm, the gradient of this or that hill, the temper of this or that customer and his choice in horseflesh. The wagon builder was obliged to be always faithful, to know always what was imposed on him in wheels, shafts, axles, carriages, everything.
I mean, over the years, we've collected old ironwork, because it's one of the hardest things that we have to get hold of is axles, original axles, and what we call boxes, which is the centre bearing. So we have collected up...
The nature of this knowledge was set out in no book.
Cut the wood out for your elm hub, and you've bored a hole in the centre and you've turned it. The next stage is you've got to get your spokes and your fellies.
Felly, one of the wooden sections of the rim of the wheel.
So in here we've got the fellies already cut out for a job. They're just having a final dry down, and they've been stacked so the air will go between. Nick's just bringing one across there.
That's the outer piece of the wheel. This sits on the spokes. This is a fairly the curved outer section.
Ash absorbs impact. it would take a lot of banging onto the ground as the wheel rolls along, whereas other woods will crack.
For some of us, learning a specific skill often proves impossible. My most bitter experience of this was going on endless courses trying to acquire the basics of stage lighting. I began at 17 and gave up about 8 years later. Sturt's own shortcomings particularly exasperated him because his father and grandfather were recognised by their employees as master craftsmen.
Precision eluded me. I was unable, up to the very last, to detect the exact angle at which the tongues of spokes should be inserted into the fellies, or the angle for dowels.
I was stepping into very new shoes, in a way, though, feeling like Sturt did, that I didn't fit.
With the idea that I was going to learn everything from the beginning, I put myself early to boys' jobs, not at all dreaming that at over 20 the nerves and muscles are no longer able to put on the cell growths and so acquire the habits of perceiving and doing which should have begun at 15.
He felt he should have started much earlier in life, and so did I. I started at 19, and I went to try to get apprenticed to a letterer, and he said, "You're too old." And I now know exactly what he means. I would love to take someone straight from school.
7 years was thought not too long for apprenticeships.
We've taken on an apprentice. He's just started about, 6 months ago?
Yes.
And he'll be going through the whole procedure, and we hope he's going to be even better than these two.
Apprentices after a year or two might be equal to making and painting a wheelbarrow.
When I worked on the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, I had an assistant from France for 4 years, and they start at 14, which seems to be a good age, and they're sent round as journeymen through the whole of France to find people working in different stones who are masters. And by the time they're 21, they're totally fabulous craftsmen.
An apprenticeship is traditionally 7 years, isn't it?
Yes, so they're clear of that in their early 20s. It's a really beautiful system that goes directly back to the 13th century in France. They're called compagnons, and it runs through all the trades, the lead workers, the stained glass makers, the bell founders, the carpenters. They all have this extraordinary training.
I was trying to learn 4 or 5 trades at once, and intellect fooled me by making it look simple. And I had to be master, as well as boy.
Sturt's book has a very specific focus. He sets out to record his business knowing that it's a threatened trade. He knows the days of horse-drawn carriages are numbered, but he proudly refuses to diversify or modernise. He's not competitive. If he were, he probably wouldn't have been so upfront about his failings and mistakes.
I made mistakes. I bought a small parcel of trees in one hollow of Alice Holt. They looked well enough.
Just behind Sturt's house in Farnham is a wood called Alice Holt, which still exists.
But when the sawyers began to saw them open, tree after tree was obviously foxy in the middle. By that I mean there was rusty-looking pith like torn string running all the way up. I don't think my father or grandfather would have bought timber from that hollow. They knew England in a more intimate way.
There's nothing in the book about Sturt's personal life, but according to the census, he never married. He lived with 2 spinster sisters, an elderly maiden aunt, and a domestic servant in Vine Cottage, Lower Bourne, about a mile from the workshop.
The working day. At that time, the Farnham local board, caring nothing for working-class convenience, had all the street lamps in the town put out at midnight. In the depth of winter, every man who went to work at 6 in the morning, and most artisans did, had to find his way without any light. On a foggy morning, nothing but a slight difference in the feel of the pavement under my feet told me that I was passing so-and-so's shop. One morning, a little glimmering light that met and passed me proved to be a lighted candle end between the fingers of a chimney sweep, against whom one might otherwise have uncomfortably blundered.
I've always enjoyed the sort of physical, you know, walking to work at the cathedral, for instance, in the cold, and the tools almost freezing to your fingers in the winter. But, you know, if you can get beyond that, you wrap your fingers around a bit of your shirt end to when you start, and you keep on banging away.
But it's not bad on a day like today, Tyrin. You can warm your back on the fire while you're waiting for it to get warm.
You get about 15 minutes of toastiness.
Yeah. These dark mornings please me better than summer mornings. For when at last I had got to my office and made up a fire in my little stove, I could usually be sure of an uninterrupted hour for my own pursuits. No man came asking me to look out nails before daylight. There was small need to wander across the dark yards. Sometimes I spent that precious hour at accounts. Oftener it was given to literary exercises, imitations of Thoreau or Emerson or Carlyle. Anything that seemed to uplift me above the sordid cares, as I thought them, that would come with daylight, so pale and chilly too. It was probably in 1885 that we left off on Saturdays at 1 o'clock instead of at 4, and it may have been about the same time that, if the shop was making overtime, we would take half an hour for tea. Then we went on from 6 to 8, a 14-hour day.
You really do get into a rhythm which can go for hours. It's very much part of what my life is.
The meal times were breakfast from 8 to 8:30, dinner 1 to 2. The ringing of Heath's bell across the street was the signal. To see the shop empty at the first stroke for dinner was to know the source of that metaphor for quickness, to go like 1 o'clock. In the afternoon, it was pleasant to spend an hour in the dry timber shed. The time of year didn't matter.
But a freezing day.
And you could stand here and we can look across to the North Downs. Lovely view that way, and we've got a view that way. And it's nice.
From the shed, I could catch glimpses of a sunny harvest field and fir woods.
The best view from here is across to the North Downs, I think, Nick, don't you?
I like that one.
That's a good
view. That's my favourite.
And also it tells us the weather, because if we can't see the downs, we know it's going to rain.
The quiet was just broken, or emphasised, by tinkling sounds from the near smithy, or by mallet strokes from the woodshop.
So there's this little spigot with water spurting out of it.
Yes, you basically drip water. You have a little bit of leather to stop it flying everywhere, except that I'm not going to do it. Downstairs, I've got my whole system much more efficient.
For some craftspeople, it's the material that governs the design. Charlotte de Silis is a jeweller who still carves her own gemstones.
What's the stone that you're cutting now?
Jade. Jade.
She makes bespoke pieces for clients, necklaces, bracelets, brooches and rings, and the Victoria and Albert Museum shows her work. For Charlotte, it's the shape and form of the gem that inspires each unique piece.
Well, I suppose I love stone because I love colour, and I also love very simple shapes. So the combination of that has created a style, of course, because the way stone is has created the way I design.
I mean, you always work with stone, pretty much.
Yes, I mean, the most I work with metal is catches for necklaces, and shanks for rings. Rings has more metal in it than anything else. I have made all jade rings, but you know, for engagement rings and things like this, of course, it's much more practical to do it in, you know, gold, silver or platinum.
You see amazing things when you go. I mean, they're real stone cutters, see, the Russians.
On Chesil Beach, near Charlotte's workshop,
She talked about the different properties of precious stones.
Opal's very soft.
Is it? Are they?
You have to be really careful buying opal, though, because you can buy a piece of opal and it'll look absolutely beautiful. Put it in a drawer for a month and it's 100 pieces. Because basically, opal is water in stone, and if it dries out, it just cracks up. So that's partly why opal is good luck in India, where impermanence is lucky. And in the West, it's bad luck because it shrinks and falls out. But it's lovely, and it's you can carve it. I mean, I've carved it. But you have to be very sure of your opal before you buy it.
Materials. The timber would lend its own subtle virtues to the man who knew how to humour it. With him, as with an understanding friend, it would cooperate. So twisting it, turning it, trying it for an inch or two this way and that way, a skilful wheelmaker was able to get the best possible product from his timber every time. Under the plane, timber disclosed qualities hardly to be found otherwise. My own eyes know, because my own hands have felt, but I cannot teach an outsider the difference between ash that is tough as whipcord and ash that is frou as a carrot or doughty or biscuity.
The vocabulary of a craftsperson was incredibly specific, wasn't it?
These are mostly terms of disapproval. If you had something that was maggoty or doughty, you would actually discard this wood. You'd probably go and burn it. If it's got a sappy smell or a wooliness of texture, you would basically throw it out. So that these are all not, you know, they're not the sort of wood you would want, any of those.
It's very, very windy, but is that normal?
Nothing.
We can't see the Orkneys from here on a good day.
On the good day, you can out to the right, just.
You can actually get out in it sometimes and just lean back.
Makes Chicago look balmy.
That's right.
In search of his own perfect stone, Simon Verity and his wife Martha bought a croft in Caithness near John O'Groats. They're spending more and more time here, even in the winter. It has two rooms. On the table in the kitchen is a Viking stone brought up from the beach, which serves as a fruit bowl. In the bedroom, Simon's decorated the walls with plaster reliefs of dancers, and there are inscriptions from Keats' poems and monastic prayers. Outside, there's a barn which is divided into a his and hers workshop. Martha builds the furniture, and Simon experiments with the local stone.
I think I feel very connected to a solid farming community like this because the carving of stone is very closely, in fact, it's as closely allied as anything to ploughing. You're ploughing through the stone and you're then retilling it to flatten the surface of the stone, having ploughed it. And if you look at a Michelangelo carving, you see in his unfinished pieces, you see the lines of the furrows that he's carving. He's going with the landscape of the stone.
How much did you do to this croft?
Well, the sheep were still living in it when we first arrived. One of the things I loved about being up here is the connection with an earlier part of my life that was very important to me. In the Cotswolds, living in an extraordinary house, the walls, floors, roofs were all of the same material, and that is true up here as in very few other parts in Britain. And because my material that I work with is stone, this is a real joy to find this.
The shop. The front was behind an ancient elm tree, with some 15 feet of sloping space separating it from the street. The windows at the side did not open. They looked out onto the little lane which led to the hop ground at the back of the shop. This lane sloped up steeply past the window, getting so high at the third window that little boys outside had to stoop if they wanted to peer down and watch the workman at his bench. Sometimes there would be a shy tapping, calling me to my office door, to find some little boy there with a penny and a, "Please, sir, can I have my hoop mended?" He was directed to the blacksmith's shop, where they knew how to shut up a hoop.
The feel will tell you more than the actual sight of seeing it. You can actually feel with your fingers whether you've got any little ridges left or anything on the job. So it is about, you know, touching and feeling what it's...
It's hand and eye. It's all about hand and eye, this sort of work, isn't it?
It was a folk industry, carried on in a folk method. But for the most part, the details were but dimly understood. The whole body of knowledge was a mystery, residing in the folk collectively, but never wholly in any individual.
As soon as I started working on these spindles, which have a different type of diamond tool, they're called sintered diamond, the diamond goes right through, you can do it in an hour, which would take me a day, you know.
So really you were struggling in the dark on your own for a long time?
For a long time I just made it up. But then, you see, when I suddenly realised, God, what an awful waste of time just from not going and finding out. Or I don't like technical books. I'm not a great reader of technical books. So, you know, in a way...
So trial and error is really important in, yes, in experimentation of it.
And also the way that I put things together. You know, I did some shells for the V&A, which is a necklace, and then one of my clients wanted a shell for herself. And I did a lapis shell, which is all edged and turns from blue to white on the inside. You know how shells, as they curl round on the inside, they change colour. So that's all in white jade on the outside. And as I got more and more experienced, I started designing in a jigsaw. So that although you glued something, there was always either a geometric structure that would hold it together.
Lock it together, yeah.
Or something that would hold it together in some way so that if glue went, it would rattle and you'd know it needed repairing.
What we had to do was to follow the customs and work to the measurements, which had been tested and corrected long before our time. I and Hand were left to their own cleverness with no guide to help them. So the work was more of an art. A very fascinating art than a science.
Nick holds the tongs. We both lift it across me on the pole, Nick on the tongs. Put the tyre over the wheel. I then have the tyre lever and pull down. Nick then drives the tyre down with a hammer after I've levered over. And I go for the first can of water.
And then it's all hands to the water cans and get it cool before the wheel starts burning, really.
In tight rings.
Why were the wheels convex? It was a detail most carefully attended to by the men in my shop, but I think none of them could have explained why it had to be so. Finally, I understood. Wheels had to be made to suit horses. Motors pull straight forward and wear down the roads differently, I'm told. And certainly their wheels have little or no dish. A wheel with a dish has the shape of a Japanese umbrella or a flattish limpet, hollowness in front, a convexity in the back. A cart sways from side to side with every step of the horse. The loaded body of cart or wagon swings to the horse's stride. Customers and pricing. The only way to make a profit would have been lowering the quality of the output, and this the temper of the men made out of the question.
Because one thing George Sturt talks about a lot is costing, pricing, marketing.
Yes.
He's trying to be very businesslike.
Yes.
And it's obviously a struggle for him, but he thinks it's got to be more and more important.
Well, it has. It is very important, and it's extremely, you know, it's extremely important. I'm afraid I've been hopeless at that. I don't promote myself and I don't market.
But how do you price?
How do I price? I have a bottom price for a ring. I won't do a ring for under 3,000. If they want a very expensive stone, that goes on top. I mean, that will cover a reasonable gemstone. But, you know, and a necklace I won't do for under 10,000.
You have to get to know a bit about the client's personality as
yes.
well.
I think that's one of the main skills. You don't think of it as a skill, but you talk to people. You introduce them to, you know, the sort of colours and the sort of gemstones you could use. And then I go away and make models. At that point, I have to get it passed by them.
And one of Charlotte's clients buys her clothing to match her jewellery.
You know, often somebody will like a stone a great deal. They will want red tourmaline or something, but that's fine. But I won't take, I want it, you know, this or that. I mean,